This is the Past Lives Podcast, episode 201, and I'm your host, Simon Baum. My mission here at the Past Lives Podcast is to investigate evidence that demonstrates survival of the human soul. We will look at past life memories, near-death experiences, spirit communication, and other incredible phenomena. This is the free one-hour version of the episode. The extended episode is an hour and 27 minutes. And to get the extra 27 minutes and the other extended versions of the episodes, you can join the Past Lives Podcast Patreon campaign. When you sign up for $5 a month, you get an extended episode every week. And for $2 a month, you get an extended episode every month. And please check out my other podcast. It's called the Alien UFO Podcast. And I release new episodes every Monday. And you can find it on almost every podcast app. There is also a new $12.50 Patreon tier, where every week you can get the extended episodes of the Past Lives Podcast and the Alien UFO Podcast extended episodes. And there are now over 45 extended episodes available to the $5 patrons. And you become a patron by going to patreon.com/Past Lives Podcast, or click on the Patreon button on my homepage at pastliveshypnosis.co.uk. Also, when you book a past life regression hypnosis session with me and you're a patron, you get a 25% discount. I'm offering a free consultation call which can be booked on my website. I have a new type of episode for this podcast called Paranormal Stories, and I'm going to continue releasing a new episode every Thursday, and I hope you like it. The links for all this stuff is in the show notes, and you can find the show notes for this and every other episode on my website. And there is a Past Lives Podcast Facebook group. And if you'd like to join, you'd be very welcome. And if you enjoy this podcast, be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. So this week I'm talking to Piero Calvi Parisetti about his book, Step Into the Light, Transform Your Fear of Death by Learning About Life After Life. Piero is a medical doctor, originally specialising in public health and disaster management. At the beginning of his career, he was employed by the International Red Cross and the United Nations. He worked in the management of large-scale humanitarian aid operations in Africa, Asia, and the former Soviet Union. In 2008, he published his book, 21 Days into the Afterlife, hailed by the New York Times bestselling author Michael Prescott as the best introduction I have seen to the survival hypothesis. His other books are Adventures in Psychical Research and Apparitions, Proof of Survival. He is a member of the Society of Psychical Research and the International Association of Near-Death Studies. Well, hi, Piero. Thanks a lot for coming onto the podcast.
It is my great pleasure, Simon. Thank you very much for having me.
So the book we're going to talk about today is called Step Into the Light, Transform Your Fear of Death by Learning About Life After Life. So basically, who is this book for? Is it aimed at a particular set of people?
Interesting. To begin with, I thought I wrote this book during lockdown. And, you know, these 2 years, particularly the first year and a half, have been really hard on me. They've been hard on a lot of people. But I took it, I really took it on the face. I make no mystery. There's no mystery about such things. I had essentially a major depression with anxiety and all that, and I know this is shared by many people. Mental health has been literally a tsunami as a consequence of the pandemic. But still, I get some satisfaction and a little pride by the fact that during this very difficult time, I managed to research and write an entirely new book. And so far, before that, I had been writing primarily with the bereaved in mind, primarily for people who were in pain, who are in pain for the loss of a loved one. And I thought I was writing this book for the other category of people whom I am convinced can greatly benefit from the results and the data coming from psychical research and afterlife science, which is the people who are in trouble with death, who are afraid of their own mortality, perhaps, or are afraid of the possible impending death of a loved one. So initially, I thought, let's say that when I wrote the book, that the book was written with these people in mind. And then it turned out to be of comfort and of help to the bereaved as well. So it's a broad set of readership I've been addressing with this book. And excuse me, we're in Europe here, and in Europe we're all familiar, I think most of us are familiar with the Lonely Planet guides. Lonely Planet. When I speak to American people, they don't really know what Lonely Planets are. Are you at all familiar with that, Simon?
Oh yeah, I've used those books.
You have indeed. Okay, what's that? When I mentioned this to American interviewers, they go glassy-eyed. They don't know it. But just to recap very briefly for our audience, a Lonely Planet is a very good idea that came about, I reckon, in the late 50s, perhaps early 60s. And the idea is very simple. You want to know about Thailand, for instance, or any tourist destination, or any destination for that matters. Where would you best get that information? Well, from people who have been to Thailand or to any other destination, and can tell you, you know, directly from the horse's mouth what it is like, and where you should go, where you should not go, and all that. And so Lonely Planet has been collecting reports essentially from travelers in essentially all countries, every countries in the world, and compiling them, collating them, editing them, and producing these beautiful guides. So if you want to go to Thailand and you want to go perhaps either on the beaten track or off the beaten track, get yourself a Lonely Planet guide to Thailand. And that's fantastic. And there are Lonely Planet guides to the most, you know, the obscure countries, relatively speaking, in the world. So a very, very good model and a simple idea that's worked very well. And when I thought of Step Into the Light, I thought exactly of a Lonely Planet guide to the afterlife, a guide which would inform those who were in fear of impending death, as I say, their own or somebody else's, about what happens before the moment of death, at the moment of transition, and then afterwards. And I don't know, I didn't know myself, and I didn't want to produce a compilation of ideas and you know, theories and systems produced by organized religions or spiritual traditions. And I thought that the best way to learn about what happens around death is to ask the people who've been there, to ask the travelers exactly in the same way the Lonely Planet guides do. And I think this is an original approach. There are a few sort of guides to the afterlife and what happens, but none have taken this particular approach. That is, take, in my case, three categories of sources, namely deathbed visions, and we will talk, if you want, we will talk about them in a bit more, near-death experiences, and those who allegedly talk to us from there, from Thailand, so to speak, from the afterlife, and can tell us what that place looks like. And there's a lot of material, there's a lot of testimony coming from these three categories of sources, of witnesses, or of travelers. But following into the tradition of my writing with my other books, and in general, my approach to this potentially very controversial subject, which is, you know, afterlife and afterlife science and everything, I don't want anybody to take my words or anybody's words just on faith. And it is very important, if we want to bring about a psychological transformation, if we want to bring about, for instance, transforming the fear of death, or helping healing the pain of the loss, it is very important for me to engage the rational part of our mind. And this is what I do in this book as well. That is, we are going to look at what these sources, these witnesses tell us. Well, we have to establish the credibility of these sources. Otherwise, why the bother? And so the first half of the book, in a way, it's a bit of a CSI, to use a popular term, as a bit of a, not forensic, but a scientific inquiry, examination into these sources. We look at what they are, who they are, who they claim to be, and at the end of the day, why it is reasonable to trust their testimony. And I hope I've done a decent work at establishing the fact that a rational person, a thinking person, somebody who likes to know and to critically challenge information, can conclude that these sources are indeed who or what they claim to be, and therefore it is reasonable, it is acceptable to recognize their testimony as presumably the truth, or a good approximation of the truth. Am I making sense?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And you were, you say you're a Western educated medical doctor and long-time university lecturer. So were you like an atheist, a materialist, and you came across information that changed your mind?
Very much so, indeed, yes. And this is a story that I've told so many times, but I I never tire of telling it because it's true. That's exactly what happened, you know. I for essentially the first 40 years of my life, I was perfectly comfortable with a materialistic, a physicalist view of the world, in as anything that can possibly exist is matter. If you cannot touch it, if you cannot measure it with instrument, it simply does not exist. And this is, you know, this is what I learned at university. And then I was an avid reader of popular science and physics and astronomy. So I was very happy to go along with that. And with that inevitably came a certain contempt for you know, woo-woo spirituality, let alone religion, and especially let alone anything quote-unquote paranormal. Until the moment when I was, what age? Very close to my 40s, so an adult. When we were living in Geneva in Switzerland at the time, my wife happened to tell me, we were having tea in the kitchen, as I say, I told this story in exactly the same details many times, but that's exactly what happened. We were having tea one afternoon, and she happened to tell me a spooky story, a relatively minor happening that happened to her in her late adolescent years. She's from Glasgow, and she was about that age when she was about to leave the family home, but was still living with her mum and dad in Glasgow. And for a few weeks, actually, yeah, maybe 3 months, she had an insistent rapping episode. There were banging and rappings behind the headboard of her bed, and she asked her father to investigate in the loft and possibly pipes, and no explanation where was found. And the thing, you know, continued quite insistently until the moment, well, I don't want to get into the details. The fact is that this was linked to an urn that her dad had brought in from you know, a flea market or something. And the urn apparently contained the ashes of somebody who had been burned. And one day the urn was accidentally spilled, and the rappings ended, as abruptly as they had started, they ended. This is the kind of story, Simon, that if yourself or anybody had told me back then, I would have, you know, smiled politely and moved on, essentially. But I could, you understand yourself, it's a small thing, it's a small happening. But I could tell that my wife was still perturbed after all these years. She had been really quite, you know, perturbed, annoyed at the time, and she was surprised at the sudden disappearance of this manifestation. That, you know, I always say she's the person I know best and I trust most in my life, and so that sort of triggered a curiosity. With the stiff upper lip I had back then, I said, let me see if anything serious, quote-unquote serious, has been written about all this stuff. And well, soon enough, immediately as I started searching, I stumbled upon the 500 plus pages written by a super credentialed psychology professor, the you know, sadly early departed David Fontana, a member of the Royal Society, for God's sake, that, you know, that sort of bypassed or took care of my boggle threshold. The guy is the real thing. And the title of the book was, and still is There an Afterlife? ? A review of the evidence. Boy, did that book change my life, or at least set in motion a process that completely turned my worldview around. You know, those 575 pages, I believe, were followed by about 30,000 and counting to this day. I became a member of the Society for Psychical Research in the UK, the International Association for Near-Death Studies in the US. I went to conferences, I went to study days, I even went to the US and trained personally with Dr. Raymond Moody, whom I consider one of my intellectual heroes, and you may remember he was the first one to popularize, to write about near-death experiences in the early 70s and became a celebrity with that. And when I say that a process was set in motion, I mean that it was not a linear process. It was not a straight line. It was a to-ing and fro-ing. It was a taking three steps forward and two steps backwards. And, you know, my materialistic physicalist self of yesteryear came back to haunt me and say, hey, come on. It is simply not possible. What are you talking about? And any new piece of information seemed to bring about a new understanding. And then the doubts came in, and so it was not an easy process. But at the end of this today, to the best of my intellectual honesty, I can say that I'm convinced of two things. Number one, that mind, what we call, you know, ourselves, our personality, mind at large, our memories, our affections, our feelings, sensations, and what we call being alive in a way, in all its mesmerizing diversity and variety, is closely related to, but independent from, the electrochemical activity of the brain. Mind is more than the brain, number one. Number two, and even less believably, if you want, in a way which we do not understand, significant aspects of human personality survive physical death. End of story. This is the only conclusion, an unbiased observer can draw if he or she truly engages with the evidence. Once you get to learn, once you challenge what you have learned, once you have reflected on what you have learned, the only conclusion you can draw is this. We don't understand, we don't know. Some claim, you know, there's the quantum field and this and that. I think this is, with all respect, not entirely honest from the intellectual point of view. I think that we have to say we do not understand. We don't begin to understand the mechanism, how this happens, but it does happen. We do not die. We, as you know, it's not our body. We are not bodies. We are consciousness. And that individualized consciousness really appears to break the barrier of bodily death and go on existing.
Hello, listeners. This is Simon. Now, as some of you know, I have a diploma in clinical hypnotherapy, and I'm certified in past life regression therapy. And in the past few weeks, I've taken many clients through some amazing and healing past life regressions. And I conduct sessions over Zoom, and I've had clients from many countries around the world. Now, when you go through a past life regression, you will feel totally in control and remember everything. And also, I record the whole session and send you an MP3 afterwards. And this gives you space to relax and go with the flow, knowing that you can listen back later and analyse what you experienced if you need to. So if you ever wanted to explore your past lives in a single session or have an issue you want to work on, you can go to my website at pastliveshypnosis.co.uk and book a free 20-minute consultation. And at the moment, I'm offering a 25% discount to everyone that has signed up to the Patreon campaign. The link is in the show notes. When it comes to evidence, what is your, would you say is your strongest evidence? For me, one of the things that stands out is people who have a near-death experience and afterwards they talk about something they saw that happened while they were brain dead and it's confirmed that it actually happened, but there's no way they could have seen it because their brain wasn't functioning. So what stands out for you as the real powerful evidence?
It's interesting, Simon. I'm asked this question very often. And for me, right from the beginning, I mean, we are confronted with such a colossal amount of evidence coming from what I reckon are about a dozen different fields of investigation, NDEs, near-death experiences being one, that it's very difficult to pick one that stands out. For me, and this point has to be put across very clearly, and our listeners and anybody who's interested in the subject has to get this point really clearly because it's fundamental. And it's I always use, it's not mine, as a metaphor I found probably already in Professor Fontana's book, and it's the many sticks metaphor. And the metaphor goes like, you know, you're in a field, in a countryside, and you go in your way, and at some stage you come across a ditch. And it's a deep ditch with dark mud, black mud at the bottom, and you want to cross it, and you don't want to fall in. And you don't know what to do. You look around yourself, and you find a bamboo field. So you break one bamboo and you have this big, thick bamboo stick. You put it across the ditch. And probably with some, you know, balancing act, the bamboo is so thick and solid that you could go across the ditch. And that, for me, is the metaphor of one element of evidence. If you look at the evidence for life after life, there are many, and you've just quoted one, there are many pieces, individual pieces of evidence, which in themselves would be strong enough to justify a rational belief in life after life. However, I am still on this side of the ditch, and I just have one bamboo stick across it. And I look around and I find another one, and I put the two side by side. And then I look a little more and I find 2, 3, 4, 5 more. And after years of looking, I have found hundreds of these very solid bamboo sticks. At that stage, I have a bridge across the ditch that I could go across with a lorry, with a tank. So solid is the bridge. The point I'm trying to make is that although there are individual pieces of evidence which are extraordinarily solid, it is the collective strength of the evidence. The fact that we have so many individual pieces of evidence and you put them together, and that this brings you to the point I was making before. The only conclusion you can draw is that you get across the ditch and you become convinced about life after life. And it is not only the fact that we have many, really many, of these individual elements, which I likened to bamboo sticks, is that this evidence is coherent and consistent. It all points to the same thing. Deathbed visions and all the end-of-life phenomena, near-death experiences, reincarnation studies, after-death communication, which in itself includes a number of sub-areas, you know, from mediumship to apparitions to poltergeists to instrumental transcommunication and blah, blah. I'd say that it's about a dozen areas, but it could be 10 or 15, depending on what you consider an individual area of investigation. Anyhow, all these major subjects or areas or disciplines within psychical research are all coherent and consistent with each other, and they all point in the same direction. So that, for me, is the strongest point, is that we have plenty of individual elements, but they come together very nicely in one logical framework. Back to you.
Well, if we can talk about near-death experiences for a short while, I wanted to ask you, what is your viewpoint on the fact that the reports can be so varied and personal? And, you know, some people might say they saw Jesus during a near-death experience, but they're not religious people. And then Christians do not see Jesus during their near-death experience. It seems like it's quite unpredictable.
In a way, I am tempted to use some of the explanations, and I will mention them. But again, my intellectual honesty forces me to say, we don't know. Because it would be stupid and dishonest to say otherwise. There's the question, very relevant questions you ask. There are other questions like, why only a variable percentage between 9% and 30% more or less of people who undergo, for instance, a cardiac arrest? We know that near-death experiences happen in a variety of situations, very broad variety of situations, but the best studied are the ones happening after a cardiac arrest. Why? Because we know very well what happens. We know very well the physiology and the sequence of processes that happen within our body after the heart stops beating. So why only between a tenth and a third of people resuscitated successfully after a cardiac arrest report a near-death experience? We don't know. There are intriguing, suggestive explanations. For instance, in the case of the last questions I asked, we know for a fact that we all dream every night, in fact, several times per night. However, not all of us remember having dreamt. So perhaps, and I say perhaps, everybody has a near-death experience after being during resuscitation following cardiac arrest. But only about a third remember having that. So it's not a matter of having the experience, it's a matter of remembering the experience. It's a suggestive explanation. I do not claim it is the explanation. Well, for the time being, we don't know. Now, concerning the variety of reports, on the one hand, it is true that there is a variety. On the other hand, it is also true that there's considerable consistency. The themes, broadly speaking, the themes appear to be the same regardless of cultural, religious, socioeconomic background, even sexual orientation, previous experiences, and to some extent even historical period, as you know, and probably many of our listeners know as well. NDEs have been reported with very similar words to the ones we hear today, already about 30 centuries ago, and they're sprinkled. There's a beautiful book by Carol Zaleski called Otherworldly Journeys, Oxford University Press, and that's a review of medieval time accounts of near-death experiences. Very little known, but this seems to be a human experience that's been reported throughout human history. Now, why the people who have an NDE tend to report the same kind of things, but using different words, different imageries, different maybe metaphors, different expressions. And then again, the bottom line, if you cornered me, I say, I don't know. Why, what's the reason for these different, slightly different, differing accounts? My answer is, I don't know. Then again, there are some interesting, suggestive, not in the sense that they suggest, but suggestive in the sense that they, how do they say, this is my old Italian mother tongue, that surfaces again, that there are charming, let's say charming possible explanations. And it's not really an explanation, but it's a way of looking at things. For instance, if you and I and another 10 people visit Paris during the month of March 2022, we've all been there. The city is the same. The time of the year is the same. We probably would have done more or less the same things if we are tourists, the Eiffel Tower, the Louvre Museum, and all the rest. And then we come back and we compile. We tell our stories about having been to Paris. And I think that we are bound to find exactly the same kind of, on the one hand, similarities, on the other hand, variability and differences that you find in NDE's accounts. So NDE, near-death experience accounts, are mediated through, faulty memory and all the cultural and psychological biases which we all carry. And this is not, it's not a mistake, or it's not a fault or anything. And why does somebody say they've seen Jesus, although they're not religious? Well, look at how our unconscious mind works during dreams. We often take one tiny element, completely marginal, completely menial, that we came across in passing, and around that we build an entire story, and it becomes the centerpiece of a major hallucinatory experience. So although somebody might not be religious, I doubt that anybody in the Western world, or possibly in the world as such, has not heard of Jesus Christ and doesn't have a sort of psychological association between Jesus Christ and very central, primordial spiritual figure. Therefore, if a person crosses over temporarily, as it seems to happen in an NDE, has the experience of meeting a being, a person, an entity that conveys the sense of being a superior spiritual entity, well, if that person, even if that person is not a committed Christian, perhaps his or her own psychological and memory and cultural biases come into play, and in that sort of semi-hallucinatory experience, when I say hallucinatory, I don't mean that things are not there. Things are there, but they are interpreted and reported through the inevitable cultural, psychological filters. I hope I'm making sense.
And what do you make of individuals who were blind from birth, who were able to report things from a near-death experience, like they could see them, but in a way they wouldn't even know what vision is?
There's one particular quote that I reported in my first book, 21 Days, from a person blind from death, who describes the kind of snow that had fallen, and he was seeing the snow being, you know, blown around by the wind in a way which is so utterly impossible to appreciate, detect, and report by somebody who's not sighted. It's very simple, and yet it's so poetic. I read the quote, and then I used it in my book, and I wrote the book, and yet every time I come across that quote, it brings tears to my eyes. So beautiful it is. That in itself blows out of the water the idea that what we call consciousness is inextricably linked to a functioning physical brain. Yes, there is obvious correlation, obvious, because, you know, neuroscience today is very good at telling, you're thinking of carrot cake, and that particular area of your brain lights up. And if I destroy that particular neuron, then you don't see the color mauve anymore, and blah, blah. I'm just making examples up. So correlation is phenomenally well demonstrated, but nobody's capable of demonstrating causation. Correlation, yes. Causation, certainly not. And we have all the veridical perceptions reported by NDEers, and of course the sight in the blind is the most extreme of these examples. But as you know, we've got plenty of very well verified accounts of perception happened at the moment when there was essentially no brain. And this is one of the things that drives me bananas and really drives me insane. Because when it comes to near-death experiences, we see the same handful of so-called explanations, which are attempt at explaining away, at trivializing or explaining the phenomenon, which have been regurgitated periodically for the last 20 plus years. And they've been, since a long time, proven to be false. False in as they do not account for what happens. They do not correspond to evidence. And yet, periodically on the mainstream media, you see the article, NDEs explained. The mystery of near-death experiences has been finally elucidated. It's the lack of oxygen in the brain. It's excess of buildup of carbon dioxide in the brain. It is a wish fulfillment or a fantasy of a dying brain, and blah, blah. And there's about 8 or 10 of these explanations, none of which accounts for facts, right? None. And yet they keep being presented and regurgitated, A, as news, and they're not because they are 10 or 20 years old, B, as, you know, fact, and they're not. They're simply lies because they do not account for the evidence. Anyhow, when materialists and physicalists are truly cornered and challenged scientifically by showing that these explanations like oxygen and carbon dioxide and temporal lobe epilepsy, etc., don't work, then the second last, there is one last, but their second last line of defense says, but you know, okay, I agree that the cortex, the part of the brain which is thought to be associated with consciousness, doesn't work. But perhaps there are centers deep down in the brain which, despite not having had blood flow from, you know, 5 or 10 minutes, they're still functioning, and they are responsible for the experience. This is laughable for two reasons. And let me, I apologize, but as a former lecturer, I get into professorial mode. But a very quick and brief lesson in neurophysiology tells us that, as we know, heart stops within 2 seconds, lights go out. Consciousness is lost. It's like fainting. Anybody who's fainted has lost consciousness. They know what it is like for consciousness to be away. After 10 seconds, breathing stops. And the fact that breathing stops already tells us that very deep and very old, evolutionarily old centers in the brain, down in the neck, essentially in the brainstem, those centers don't work anymore. So if those centers don't work, how could there be anything working in the brain anywhere? And fundamental reflexes like the gagging reflex or the corneal reflex, which are very simple arc reflex neurological entities, they're also out. That shows us that there is no brain. There's not one or two neurons working and producing this experience. So that explanation is already blown out of the water. But at the same time, let all of us remind ourselves that any theory of consciousness, and there aren't any, let's be very clear. There are a dozen, possibly two dozens, competing theories for how consciousness could arise from matter. None by admission of the same neuroscientists and neuropsychologists who try to come up with these things, none to the present day accounts for the fact that we have consciousness. Anyhow, all of them have one feature in common. They require the function, not only the functioning of the cortex, but the functioning of a broad range of different brain structures, which should be functional and coordinated, all This does not happen during an NDE. There is no brain. And yet people perceive. And yet people build memories which last 20, 25, 30 years. Let me ask you something, Simon. And through you, I ask all our listeners. Let's stop for a moment and think of the countless hours we spent in primary school, secondary school, college, and maybe university, trying to remember things, actively trying to memorize and remember things. With our full capacities and full faculties, our brains were switched on and working perfectly fine. And yet, 10, 20, 30 years later, we remember maybe 5%, 10% of what we so painstakingly and painfully tried to memorize. Now, in the case of NDEs, we have people with no functioning brain, I would say no brain at all, who are able to remember what they described as a hyperconscious experience in minute details 25 or 30 years after the experience has been had. Then again, that flies in the face of materialism and physicalism. That in itself would be enough for us to tell no. Mind, personality, memory are somehow related to the brain, but they're independent. Because people with no brain have experiences, see, perceive, build memories, and even have long-lasting psychological and behavioral changes as a result of an experience which was had when they had no brain. That is conclusive in itself. That's a huge bamboo stick.
And then in the book, we move on to deathbed visions, which is when people are close to death, maybe within days or sometimes weeks, they start to have these connections with people that have passed on and all sorts of visions, don't they?
It is extraordinary. For some reason, these experiences and these phenomena have less press, they're less known by the general public compared to near-death experiences. However, if you speak to the professionals, if you speak to doctors and nurses, the people and hospice workers, the people who are there when you know people come close to death, they say, of course, this happens all the time. To the point that deathbed visions are taught in a number of university courses for nurses. And obviously, you know, universities don't take any position on the nature of these experiences, but they tell nurses why. Because nurses are so likely to be exposed to these kind of experiences with their patients. And so they need to be prepared and know how to react and how to, you know, handle the thing from a professional to patient point of view. The beauty is that here we do have research, and we have research already from the early 60s. Erlander is the first name that evaded me. And Carly Sozis of this American Society for Psychical Research already in the early 60s sent out 10,000 questionnaires to health professionals in India and in the US. Why two countries? Because they wanted to compare their findings across different health systems and particularly different belief systems and, you know, cultural backgrounds and everything. And their results, which have been confirmed by subsequent studies, are enlightening. And they say they found out that about 10% of us are conscious at the moment of passing, which is surprising for me. I thought we would have been a higher percentage, but of the people who are hospitalized or institutionalized in a hospice or care home, statistics tell us that 10% are conscious at the moment of their passing. Of these, two-thirds, and I mean, it's a huge, it's a spectacular number, two-thirds report visions of what appears to be the afterlife and engage in sustained communication with partners of people they can see and other people cannot, although there are exceptions, and we may come to that in a moment, who are deceased relatives, who are said to be deceased relatives, said to have come across to facilitate the passing over of people. And this happens in maybe not weeks, but most frequently within 36 or 48 hours from the moment of death. And so it's a phenomenally, phenomenally prevalent phenomenon. And there are two features well demonstrated and well, you know, supported by research and you know, empirical evidence, which for me completely stand out and make this kind of experiences and phenomena truly extraordinary. Because there again, you know, we've had generations of, so to speak, skeptics and scoffers and debunkers saying, oh, it's this, oh, it's fantasy, oh, it's, you know, hallucination and blah, blah, etc. And in my book, and I'm certainly not the first one to do that, I engage in a systematic scientific dismantling of these attempted explanations, simply because they don't work. Again, they do not account for the evidence for what happens. The two things that really make it for me and I find extraordinary are, number one, the finding that, and hear me very well here, people who think they're going to die but end up making a recovery do not have deathbed visions. Conversely, people who think are going to make a recovery but in reality end up dying do have deathbed visions. This is extraordinary in itself. It shows us that it is not fantasy, it is not wish fulfillment, it is not a projection, it is not a psychological mechanism. Evidence, this particular element, piece of evidence, points to the fact that it is proximity to the actual death that triggers this phenomenon. It is like as we approach the shedding of the material body, if there was a filter that gets opened and allows us, enable us to peek into a broader reality that includes, you know, the world that is to come and the reality that is to come. Very, very interesting. And the other, you know, piece of evidence, which I find equally extraordinary, is that there's a number of very well documented and researched cases in which deathbed visioners, people who have deathbed visions, report seeing and have conversations with deceased relatives they did not know they were dead at the moment the vision takes place. So if this was a fantasy, or again, wish fulfillment, why do people only see deceased relatives? And even more so, how can they see a deceased relative whom they didn't know was dead at the moment the vision takes place? So very, very strong puzzling, and it's, there's no two ways around. I mean, I cannot, no matter how complicated, how far-fetched, I really cannot think of any alternative explanation. The simplest and quite possibly the only explanation is that, yes, people having deathbed visions do interact with discarnate personalities who inhabit a different realm, a different, yes, realm of existence, which is not material and which is very likely to be the realm that we ourselves, all of us, are going to inhabit once we've shed our physical body.
Well, it's been such a fascinating conversation, and we've only covered such a small amount of stuff that's in the book, and you've got other books out as well. Could you tell us about your other books?
Briefly, because I'm not sure people are they want to hear information. Anyhow, I started in 2008, in fact. My first thing was called 21 Days into the Afterlife, which I'm humbled to say it was reviewed as, quote, one of the best, or possibly the best, introduction to the survival hypothesis by somebody who knows these things very well. And I'm really proud and humbled about that. And, you know, reviews of the evidence for the afterlife, they're a penny a dozen. There are plenty which have been written. My original contribution there is that, A, it's a very popular account. Popular as in popular science, is directed to the general public, and it is in the format of a dialogue. And this is what was really liked, and that was has made it a little internet publishing success. It's been translated in 5 languages. It's 21 days of a dialogue between myself and a skeptic, or rather I should say myself at the moment I've written the book and myself a few years before, saying, what are you talking about? Are you completely bonkers? You want to talk about the afterlife? And I say, no, hold on a sec. I'm not here to convince you. I don't ask you to believe anything. Please follow me as I lay out the evidence, in a way, as we've been doing in our conversation here. And so in 21 days, we review as many areas of evidence, and at the end, obviously the skeptic has to sort of surrender, and unwillingly surrender. Then I've published Adventures in Psychical Research, which is a collection of essays. Then I've written Apparitions, which is, excuse my hubris, is a good book, honestly, and it is available for free on my website, drparisetti.com, dr as the prefix for doctor, dr Parisetti, Paris like the city in France, E-T-T-I at the end, drparisetti.com. You will find several articles, some a little bit on the technical side, but possibly interesting. And you will find Apparitions, this book, which is there in a full book, available for free download. And then you will find links to my other books, 21 Days, Adventures in Psychical Research, this big, big opus of the video course, plus my self-help manual, which is called Love Knows No Death. And this is something which I humbly but wholeheartedly recommend to anybody who suffered a loss, as in trouble with that pain. This is, as I say, the manual is centered around cognitive behavior psychology techniques, and it refers, and it has to be used together with this 8 hours of video course. It's like a popular science university course on the evidence for afterlife. And finally, this came out just about a year, April last year, Step Into the Light, which is the Lonely Planet Guide to the Afterlife, in a way.
Well, thanks a lot for coming on the podcast. It's been a fascinating conversation.
Simon, it is such a great pleasure for me. And I always, in these interviews, I'm always so grateful to the host because you are fundamental. The work you do is as important as the work we do. We produce information and you are the channel through which this information can reach people. People get to know about the subjects that we care about and our mutual interest. And so as a channeler and a promoter of this culture and this information, I really bow to you and thank you for your great work.
And thank you. And that was an interview with Piero Calvi Parassetti about his book, Step Into the Light, Transform Your Fear of Death by Learning About Life After Life. A great way to support the podcast is to sign up on Patreon. Just go to patreon.com/pastlivespodcast or click on the button on my homepage at pastliveshypnosis.co.uk. This is the free 1 hour version of the episode. The extended episode is an hour and 27 minutes. If you join the $2 a month tier, you get an extended episode every month. If you join the $5 a month tier, you'll have access to an extended episode every week and the back catalogue of extended episodes. Also, if you're a patron, you get a 25% discount when you book a past life regression session with me. And please check out my new podcast. It's called the Alien UFO Podcast, and I release new episodes every Monday. And you can find that on almost every podcast app. My Instagram is the Past Lives Podcast with an underscore between each word, and on Twitter I am at Simon G. Bowne. And if you enjoy this podcast, be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.